marching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Oh, hear the people singing, bread and roses.
Climate change may be the most pressing, most wicked environmental problem facing humankind, but it may also be our best opportunity to address underlying economic, political, and cultural diseases that give climate change its appearance of inevitability. The encyclical will help to diagnose and minister to those underlying pathologies so that if we do indeed heal the planet, we may also have a humanity worthy of inheriting it.
Bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing. Bread and roses.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in the Pioneer Valley in Northampton. And we are streaming live at valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Elliot Tarry, your host for today's session. And in the studio with me is my co-host, new co-host on the Bread and Roses show, Una Daugherty. Una, welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Yeah. And what Una and I are going to be doing today on the Bread and Roses show is talking about Pope Francis and the upcoming encyclical, the expected, long-awaited, as they say. That phrase is used continually with the word encyclical. Long-awaited, anticipated, all those other adverbs, with the papal encyclical, which is said to be his first, but it isn't actually. He did one last year. But his first major encyclical.
And as popes go, what a guy.
What a guy. He's actually, that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about what a guy and the impact that this encyclical is having, not only on the climate crisis, as he's calling it, debate, but upon all sectors of the political spectrum, including the left. But so we're going to get into that. But first, Una, I want to find out and have the audience know a little bit about you. And you just told me that you have a book coming out.
I do. I do have a book coming out. This is, I'm very excited about it, actually. It's, I think I first decided I wanted to write a book when I was seven, reading the Narnia series. So here we are, years later.
And the book is?
The book is called During the Truce, and it's about my time in Bogota, Colombia, in the 1980s, when the guerrilla forces and the army were in truce. It was a brief period of time, and unfortunately was fatal for much of the guerrilla leadership. But I was lucky enough to live in Bogota then, and I got to meet people from many different sectors of society, ranging from people in the military to some of the guerrillas. I talked to street kids, middle-class Colombians. And I started thinking about it again. Actually, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has just made some important findings against the Colombian military to do with some incidents with the guerrillas in the 80s. So I'm glad to be having the book coming out, and I've enjoyed thinking about that time and remembering it.
And what was your background that brought you there?
I was actually an undergraduate Latin American history major at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and they had a program where they sent students to study Spanish and history in Bogota.
Oh. Well, as we know, Pope Francis is from Argentina, and that whole time that you were there, there was this intense movement in the Catholic Church. Actually, it was suppressed by the Catholic Church, called Liberation Theology, that was on the side of the oppressed masses, and it was oppressed because it was considered Marxist.
And yeah, now that's interesting because Colombia, liberation theology was particularly unpopular in Colombia. In many of the Central American countries, there were archbishops or members of the church hierarchy that were actually really supportive of this, the struggle for justice for the poor. In Colombia, that was not the case. The church was very conservative there. And also, one of the first liberation theologists was a priest called Camilo Torres Restrepo, and he was a Colombian. And he actually joined the Colombian guerrilla forces, the EPL. And his famous quote was that if Jesus were alive today, he would be a guerrilla. So when you have somebody like that early on in liberation theology movement, as they did in Colombia, it made the church hierarchy very conservative and wary of liberation theology in general.
Well, we're going to touch on how that intersects with the Pope's history a bit and his present, actually, in an interesting way, and how it intersects with the encyclical that's expected. And I want to just give a note about what an encyclical is, as many people may not appreciate what an encyclical is. An encyclical is the highest form of teaching document issued by a pope, and it is written in Latin with quotes from scripture and moral exegeses, as they say, if you can say it. This particular encyclical, however, has had input from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and social science experts, and of course, this pope has a master's degree in chemistry.
I didn't know.
Yes, he does. He was a chemist before he was a Jesuit. So, without further ado, the voice that you heard in the beginning under our theme was that of Yale Law Professor Doug Kaiser, speaking about the eagerly awaited papal encyclical on climate change by Pope Francis. Professor Kaiser was part of a panel discussion at Yale in April, sponsored by the Department of Forestry and Environmental Studies, in conjunction with the Yale joint venture with the Divinity School at Yale. A panel discussion focused entirely upon the impact of the Pope's encyclical. Now, that panel discussion was early April, the first week in April just passed, and they were talking about a meeting that was going to be coming up. This meeting of environmental science and religion at Yale was preceded by a few weeks, a day-long meeting of science and religion meets policy that was held at the Vatican in Rome on April 28th. It was billed as Morality Meets Science, a dialogue between science and religion, with leaders of all major religions in attendance and hosted by the Vatican's Pontifical Academy of Sciences on April 28th of just past this year. The Vatican and Pope Francis hosted that one-day event titled Protect the Earth, Dignify Humanity, the Moral Dimensions of Climate Change and Sustainable Development. Let me read that again. This is the title of their talk. Protect the Earth, Dignify Humanity, the Moral Dimensions of Climate Change and Sustainable Development. In what can only be described as a full-court press, Pope Francis is targeting climate change by framing it as climate crisis, to the outrage of the science-denying right-wing group Heartland Institute, which picketed outside the event in Rome. Pope Francis has been extremely outspoken on the issue of climate change, and he is now walking his talk. And today on the Bread and Rose Show, we'll be looking at the impact that Pope Francis is having on the climate debate and on world leaders as they head toward December's UN Framework Agreement Conference on Climate Change in Paris, which will attempt to set new goals for carbon emissions and other agreements, which have the effect of treaty. The impact that this pope is having upon this issue cannot be overstated, I believe. It is causing a significant tectonic shift of consciousness and conscience in status quo power circles on issues of climate justice and honoring the earth. So later in the show, I'm going to be reading a statement, an article by longtime peace and justice activist Tom Hayden from his Peace and Justice or Peace Journal, which is on this subject. And it's an incredible article. And Tom Hayden clearly understands the breadth and depth of the Pope's advocacy. So later we'll be reading parts of that and discussing that. Una and I will be discussing that. Una or Una?
Una.
Una.
Like Luna Noel.
Okay. That... I would have said uno, due, tre, quattro, cinque. No.
It's the Italian versus the Spanish, I guess.
Number one. Uno. Una. Okay. All right. First, let's do some background on last month's activities in Rome. The event brought together scientists, faith leaders, businesses, NGOs, and politicians for a series of panel discussions. According to the conference website, the mission statement of intent reads... The desired outcome is a joint statement on moral and religious imperative of dealing with climate change in the context of sustainable development, highlighting the intrinsic connection between respect for the environment and respect for people, especially the poor, the excluded, victims of human trafficking and modern slavery, children and future generations. And by all accounts, they achieved that goal and issued a joint statement. I believe it was on Democracy Now! When that conference ended that they focused on the human trafficking part of the statement and did a long piece on the fact that the Pope is very concerned. He preaches and has been talking publicly about the damage and the horror of human trafficking, and he's relating it to climate change.
That's an interesting connection.
Saying as and this encyclical is expected to do just that, saying that the hardest hit, of course, are the poor and those, and that the mass migrations of people are a result in some parts of the world due to climate change and the socioeconomic and political pressures that are caused by that.
Really makes a lot of sense.
And the traffickers take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was focused on Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Focused on that, but it's more inclusive. It has many different dimensions in that statement, and you can go to their website. I'll give you the website later, and they have a copy of that statement. But lest one think that this is a flash in the pan. This conference is part of a Vatican strategy of consensus building in preparation for the Pope's eagerly awaited first encyclical for release this June on, of course, the moral dimensions of the climate crisis. On this point, Yale's Dean of Forestry and Environmental Studies, Peter Crane, speaking to an assembly at the university in April, said the encyclical will give new prominence to the moral dimension of climate change, bridging the divide between religion and science. Dean Crane also pointed out that the encyclical and Vatican conference do not appear in isolation, but are part of a process that began in Copenhagen in 2009. Now, I'd like to take a brief aside and highlight this theme of science meets religion, which is a large part of the buzz, I guess, if you call it, that the Pope is generating. The traditional characterization due to historical events is one of Catholic Church versus science polarity that I guess started with Galileo. But the reality is that the Catholic Church made peace with the theory of evolution in the mid-20th century with the influence of Teilhard de Chardin and has an established Academy of Science that I mentioned before. Now, of this science and religion duality, Yale's Dean of Forestry, Peter Crane, speaks of it as almost illusory. Let's hear what Professor Peter Crane at Yale has to say about it.
So, speaking as a scientist, science and religion, in their own ways, both awaken a sense of awe and wonder at the complexity and beauty of life. And combined with the indisputable link between the health of people and communities and the health of the environment, the encyclical will emphasize the care and humility that's needed in our relationship to the natural world, and that has moral and ethical dimensions. A little under a year ago, the Pope made a short speech in which he emphasized, quote, the beauty of nature and the grandeur of the cosmos. He emphasized that that was a Christian value. As a scientist, I'd go further. I'd say it's a universal value, and it's a universal value that I think most scientists would subscribe to with enthusiasm.
All right, Una, what's your take on that?
I just think that's so well put. I've never really understood why there was necessarily this polarity between science and religion. Maybe in the time of Galileo, but not today.
Well, there's the polarity that the right wing creationists are creating, and there's the historical polarity in the church that goes back to Galileo, mainly because Galileo interfered with the concept of the Lord of the Universe that had been around for maybe almost 2,000 years. And on the left, there are the secularists, the atheists, who pretend to represent science. So you have that those currents still active, still there. And others, and many scientists, are religious people, and they don't see. And Albert Einstein was, and many leaders of the 20th century science were very much religious, or had a belief in an ultimate creator of some sort. It just doesn't seem to get, particularly on the left, it doesn't seem to connect to social issues. And this Professor Crane also points that the encyclical's linkage has linkages with social justice issues. Mm-hmm. So it's combining the science with social justice issues. And I think the reason that I'm talking about this today on the Bread and Roses show is because I know my brothers and sisters are out there that could care less about the Pope and have never and don't want to pay attention. And I think it's to our detriment. And I did think during the and I said this many times during the war years in which we were on the streets, that we needed to combine spirituality with the anti-war movement. We needed to be up front, and that never was allowed.
I think in many ways to sort of, to be a human being is to be spiritual. I mean, if you look at different cultures from all over the world, it's actually quite unusual to find a culture where there isn't a spiritual practice or dimension, particularly non-Western cultures. And I think it's short-sighted for people on the left to condemn any kind of spirituality as being delusional or irrelevant. When you think of the Pope and the influence he has in the world, and the millions of people who are Catholics, many in developing countries in Latin America, his influence is incredibly important.
We're going to be striking that note quite a few times. It's this fellow, I'm also going to quote Andrew Revkin, who writes for the New York Times, points out that the Jesuit schools in this country alone number 2,500, and this encyclical is already the background for it, and the background teachings are already being placed in the curriculum for a younger generation of Catholics, and that never seems to get it's off the radar. Somehow in the left. But anyway, that's the reason one of the main motivations on my part for talking about the Pope and his influence. I want the left to see beyond the gatekeepers of the left who seem to frame the debate, and see that there's a broader world out there of power.
Absolutely.
Of power brokers, and this Pope is leading the charge for something that we all care very deeply about in the movement. Okay, now getting back to the Yale conference that I was talking about, the moderator of that conference, or that panel discussion, John Grimm, it was his name, who co-heads the with the Divinity School, a joint master's program of environmental studies and forestry. So the Yale already gets it. They've got a master's program.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, combining their Divinity School with the environment and environmental studies. And he points to this linkage of the of social justice and the term created by Pope Francis's encyclical and Pope Francis himself to express this social justice environment linkage. And that term is integral ecology. That's the term that's going to be, it's been leaked. It's going to be coming out in the encyclical. Integral ecology. And the term seeks to bridge the environmental degradation that occurs around us with social justice in what is being called eco-justice, as well as climate justice, but they're calling it eco-justice. So these are two terms that are going to come out in the encyclical, integral ecology and eco-justice. And on this point, we can listen again to the Yale professor, Doug Kaiser, who in capsule form, in really articulate or capsule form, he articulates the economic and political morass that envelops the climate crisis issue as the context for why the Pope's concept of integral ecology is so important. So let's hear from law professor Doug Kaiser, if I can...
We'll have it in a minute. A couple of technical problems.
Yeah, let's see.
You know, one thing that interested me about the quote that you played earlier was he talked about the sense of awe the more one learns about or observes the natural world. And I think that kind of awe is a pretty spiritual thing. And that's why I don't understand the dichotomy.
Yeah,
the more you learn, the more marvelous it is.
If you've ever listened to theoretical physicists talk and have discussions about string theory or any of the concepts of the Big Bang compared, they get so high and giddy. And it's almost like it is a religious experience for them, because what they're doing is discussing the tenets of the religion of science,
mm-hmm.
the mythologies, which when you get into theoretical physics, it's mythology. They say they measure things, but come on, it's all mathematical, theoretical, and they just in talking about it, they're going to a place within the human psyche that can only that approaches the cosmic, and that is the source of most religious experiences as well. So there is that connection
mm-hmm.
on a deep. You can't avoid it. I think some scientists once called it the God gene or something like that. Anyway, now let's hear. And I think we can get Doug Kaiser, law professor at Yale, talking about the importance of, or this concept of integral ecology.
If the U.S. Congress got its act together, we could reach 80% of our country's greenhouse gas emissions by regulating fewer than 3,000 entities through an upstream carbon tax. We could start collecting this tax tomorrow, because the necessary entities are already subject to administrative tax collection regimes. And tomorrow, we could also start returning the economic value of that tax to individuals through a linked reduction in payroll taxes. The logic of this policy is so simple a kindergartner could grasp it, but our Congress cannot. Tax bad things, not good things. Pollution is bad, employment is good, voila. So why have we failed to adopt this simple and obvious policy that would help to fulfill the urgent climate responsibilities that we have already acknowledged and accepted as a matter of international law? The answer is complex, and I can only offer here a very crude, digested version, but it goes like this. Because the global climate policy process has been held hostage by a country, this country, which has found its own political process held hostage by economic interests that are capable of investing not only in traditional capital, but also in the capture of laws and institutions that are intended to regulate capital. so that more and more of the rewards from human cooperation accrue in unequal proportions to a self-perpetuating and unaccountable elite. So, now I can answer the question posed to this panel of why the forthcoming encyclical is important. The encyclical is important because Pope Francis will not merely address climate change and humanity's obligation of planetary stewardship. He will address those issues within the context of what he calls an integral ecology that encompasses concerns of economic justice, true human development, and global solidarity.
All right, there you have it. In a nutshell, I'm just kind of really in awe of that statement where he just put the frame around it of how the powers that be and the elites have bought everything around the process, and how it's basically, he's saying the Pope is making an end run around the way it's structured now by bringing in this other dimension and the concept linkage concepts of integral ecology. I think that's brilliant. All right, Professor Kaiser, who we just heard, was to address the legal and policy implications of the encyclical broadened, but he broadened the scope by applying the encyclical concept of integral ecology as a palliative to the world's underlying cultural, cultural pathologies, cultural and what pathologies? I can't remember. Well, anyway, he sees this concept of the integral ecology as a somehow able to address all those pathologies, the ethical pathologies, the cultural pathologies, and then he goes on to quote Pope Francis in reinforcing that. So we're going to hear that again. I hope.
Computers.
Pope Francis recognizes, as he said during his All Saints Day homily last year, that, quote, we are capable of devastating the earth far better than the angels. And he continued, this is exactly what we are doing. We destroy creation, we devastate lives, we devastate cultures, we devastate values, we ravage hope. He also recognizes, as he told the World Meeting of Popular Movements, that an economic system centered on the god of money needs to plunder nature to sustain the frenetic rhythm of consumption that is inherent to it. And finally, as he told delegates to the UNFCCC last year, Pope Francis recognizes that the effective struggle against global warming will only be possible with a responsible collective answer that goes beyond particular interest and behavior and is developed free of political and economic pressures. Climate change may be the most pressing, most wicked environmental problem facing humankind, but it may also be our best opportunity to address underlying economic, political, and cultural diseases that give climate change its appearance of inevitability. The encyclical will help to diagnose and minister to those underlying pathologies so that if we do indeed heal the planet, we may also have a humanity worthy of inheriting it.
All right. That, again, was Professor Kaiser from Yale, law professor, very articulate, and quoting the Pope. So the encyclical has not even been released, and it's already having a big impact in academic and religious circles. But as the world leaders are digesting his encyclical when it comes out in June, Pope Francis will be readying to travel to Washington, D.C. in September to deliver his message to a joint session of Congress where 167 members are Catholic, including House Speaker John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, and President Pro Tem of the Senate, Vice President Joe Biden. And from D.C., he heads to New York City to address the 70th anniversary of the United Nations Assembly, where, of course, the Vatican holds, I believe, an observer mission. Many overlook the fact that the Pope is not only the head of the Catholic Church and spiritual leader of over a billion Catholics worldwide, he's also the head of state, that independent state being the Vatican. As stated before, the April 28th conference was chaired by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, but also co-sponsored by the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and the Religions for Peace organization. The keynote address was delivered by United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said, "We are the first generation that can end poverty, but the last that can take steps to avoid the worst impacts of climate change." The New York Times columnist and conference attendee Andrew Revkin had this observation of Ban Ki-moon. His presence was a further statement to the influence the papal encyclical is already wielding. Revkin is the Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University's Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies. According to Revkin, the declaration released at the Vatican has sections on the basics of climate change science, global economic trends, and the sustainable development goals that are going to be finalized at this year in the United Nations discussions. It is also interesting to note that the panel on sustainable development was chaired by Jeffrey Sachs, who, among his other distinctions, is the director of the UN Sustainable Development, Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is a co-sponsor of the Vatican event. And another highlight of the conference was an address by Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa, who quoted Pope Francis in his opening statement, saying, "Earth, which is mother to us, to all of us, asks for respect and not violence, or worse still, the arrogance of bosses. We must hand it over to our children, improved, well cared for, because she is alone that has been made to us." A very heartwarming sentiment to anyone familiar with Native American teachings of honoring the needs of the seventh generation, hence, by our actions in the present. And the language the Pope chooses to use signals more than just a nod to the indigenous teachings and the struggle of indigenous groups throughout South and Central America. It signals a real solidarity with those groups. I think I have a song here, Una. We have a song that summarizes the seventh generation sentiment. Here's some music by a duo called Good Oak and Owl. And let's see if we can hear that.
Song for Pachamama.
Oh, that would be nice. I don't know.
Go to the mountain in the great circle. An eagle flies there. It's a sign. Seeker of knowledge, searcher of power, given a vision in a dream. It's the air we breathe, water that we drink, land that grows our food. Cherish the children, they are the future. Show them the way, give them love. Mystery moon, powerful sun, wonderful earth, you remain. Plenty for light to the spirit. Let there be gladness, world understanding, unity. Radiant people, justice and freedom. You're the new teachers, give us light. Like the rushing river, where's the way, the mountain? No more to little people who say only they have the truth. Listen for wisdom to harmony teachers who, like the rain, touch us all. Seven generations, we respect all life.
All right. You are listening to a song called Seven Generations, and that's by a duo produced in 1997, a duo called Good Oak and Owl, and that was off that was the title song from their 1997 album called Seven Generations. And we are the Bread and Roses Show. My name is Elliot Terry. I'm here with Una Daugherty, co-host, and we are talking about the Pope, Pope Francis, and just before that song on the Seventh Generation, which talks about the Native American concept or teachings of elders of keeping the earth and resources for the seventh generation, keeping it in mind that whatever we use and whatever we do will have an impact on the seventh generation, which is the teaching of the Native American, North American Native elders. But also the language, we were talking about the language that the Pope is using, that it seems to me more than just a nod to the indigenous teachings, and he's talking about Mother Earth, and he's combining that with the image of Saint Francis. And Tom Hayden wrote an article in his blog or his newsletter, which is the Democracy Journal. Tom Hayden has now the Peace and Justice Resource Center, and he writes the Democracy Journal on a regular basis. And one of the articles this month was Pope Francis Calls for Climate Justice. And he goes in depth into a lot of the history. And he talks about this connection that the Pope has with the indigenous. He says, first of all, Francis, who teaches us a profound respect for the whole creation and protection of our environment, which all too often, instead of using for the good, we exploit greedily to one another's detriment. We are losing the attitude of wonder, contemplation, listening to creation. The implications of living in this horizontal manner is that we have moved away from God. We no longer read his signs. That's Pope Francis talking about why he chose Francis, namesake Saint Francis, as his name. And then he, Tom Hayden goes on to say, last year his analysis sharpened. Pope Francis says, creation is not a property which we can rule over at will, or even less, is the property of only a few. Creation is a gift. It is a wonderful gift that God has given us. We have, in a sense, lorded over nature, over sister Earth, over Mother Earth. I think man has gone too far. Thank God that today there are voices that are speaking out about this. That was a quote from Pope Francis. And
what a remarkable thing for a pope to say.
Yes, yes. And it's right in the spirit of St. Francis, who spoke with the animals, spoke with the birds, the wolves, and he wrote a prayer to the brothers and sisters of the animal kingdom. So Tom Hayden, goes on to say, it is unclear whether Pope Francis will embrace the stewardship model of the human role in creation, the mainstream view of leaders like Al Gore, who explore the kinship model embodied, or explore the kinship model embodied by the original Francis, St. Francis, many native people, environmental biologists, and counterculture people. When the Pope speaks of Mother Earth, he consciously uses the language of the indigenous of Latin America, not the cold terminology of those who believe that he can engineer nature in the face of looming catastrophe. The Pope is moving towards what many, like Matthew Fox, have described as creation spirituality, a theological response to corporate Christian and market fundamentalism. In this wider view, all of creation is considered the holy work of God, not a backdrop to the human drama, nor is the earth a mere storehouse of raw materials set aside for human exploitation. Unlike some current forms of environmentalism, the Pope's view arises from an underlying commitment to the poor, rooted in the liberation theology movement that arose in Latin America in the late 60s. As a rector in Buenos Aires during the dictatorship of the 1980s, the future Francis was entangled in questions of whether liberation theology doctrine had become only a mask for materialist doctrines of the left. Now here, see, there's the rub, the materialist. Controversy broke out over whether future pontiff Joseph Ratzinger issued a silencing order on Leonardo Boff, a Franciscan from Brazil, an advocate of liberation theology. The silencing lasted 9 months and stirred widespread opposition to Ratzinger across Latin America. Ratzinger, who headed the former office of the Inquisition, was a favorite of Catholics in the Ronald Reagan administration, who fiercely opposed liberation theology and did everything to undermine it. Among his first acts as the new pope, Francis welcomed Boff and another founder of liberation theology, Peru's Father Gustavo Gutierrez, to reconcile with him in the Vatican. Boff, 74 years old, immediately issued this ringing statement about the new pope. Francis isn't a name. It's a plan for a church that is poor, simple, gospel-centered, and devoid of all power. It's a church that walks the way together with the least and the last, that creates the first communities of brothers and sisters who recite the breviary under the trees with the birds. It's an ecological church that calls all beings into sweet words, those sweet words, brothers and sisters. The first Francis was obedient to the church and the popes, and at the same time he followed his own path with the gospel of poverty in hand. According to Boff, in 1995, the original Francis was a mystic who wrote the hymn Brother Sun, Sister Moon when he was sick and almost blind, partly as a result of his long 13th century struggle against the Vatican's 1%. He violated the norms of his age through his love for Claire of Assisi, for his embrace of beggars, and for his speaking to the birds and wolves. The original Francis embodied kinship with the universe. After his death, the Vatican institutionalized many of his followers in a new order, the Franciscans. Many feel that Francis died of a broken heart. Of course, the Franciscans went on to California to brutalize the indigenous peoples, but we won't mention that completely, as I just did. But what do we say?
It's when the bureaucracy sets in, yeah, these things happen.
So you were in Latin America.
Yes.
How did this these words, this terminology, sister, mother terminology that he's using, what did you sense in Latin America and South America of that movement, both movements, the creation spirituality and the liberation spirituality?
Well, I was first in Latin America as a 10-year-old, as a young child, in a very small town, village, really, that was mostly Mayan. And I remember going into the church, and I think that I understood even then that the church was, I won't say nominally Catholic, but certainly not Catholic in the sense of a Catholic church in the United States. It was obviously a very holy place for the people that were that were there. I remember when there was Mass, everyone would just bring their children. People would walk in and out, light candles. Somehow it wasn't as regimented, and you could just see that the church itself was a really important place. I know that throughout Latin America, churches have been built upon the ruins of pre-conquest temples, and that the religion is and continues to be very respectful of the earth and of nature. I've, particularly in the countries that are mostly Native American, I've been to Guatemala and Ecuador, and I've been to Peru and Bolivia. And you can see that the worship of nature and the respect for nature is continuous in the Catholic churches. Sometimes people bring in the corn, where we'd use palms on a Palm Sunday. Mm. In North America, people will bring in corn to be blessed and shake the corn during the service. I'm not being very articulate about this, but it resonates as completely true what Hayden says, that the Pope using this language about Mother Earth is acknowledging of and deeply respectful of the worldview of many of the indigenous people of Latin America. And for that, you've got to love the guy.
I'm a pagan, and I've done a lot of Native American ceremony, and for and a former Catholic when I was young. I was brought up Catholic. For me to hear a Pope refer to the earth as Mother Earth, mm-hmm. I can't tell you what that does. That is just awesome in my mind, because he's doing heavy lifting. From my perspective, he's doing some heavy lifting right now in an area where you can be attacked for being a tree hugger. You know, if you are a tree hugger, or the environmental movement for decades. Anyone who tried to spiritualize their experience with the earth was ridiculed and attacked as, you know, some kind of cult fanatic. This is just, it's just really thrilling to me to have this kind of language
and
being used.
It's so strange, because indigenous cultures all over the world are deeply connected to place, to the mountains and the lakes, the rivers that surround them. To the home village, almost like what I said before, when sometimes I think that to be human is to be spiritual outside of Western culture. So it's strange to me that anybody would attack that.
Well, you know, people have their rigidity of thought and isms and ideologies that you know, that it seems that it's time to put these aside and build a real movement, because as Al Gore has said, the earth is in the balance. And I heard a little clip on YouTube of Al Gore saying that he's so impressed with the Pope he would become Catholic. And he told a joke. He said, "Is the Pope Catholic?" And then he had to say, "It's a joke. It's a joke." But So Tom Hayden goes on to talk about the process that that the Pope seems to be engaged in, and that began, as they said, in 2009 with the Copenhagen talks, but that this Pope is just putting his ducks in a row. He says the process leading to the coming encyclical has been a long one. In 1992, at the first UN climate summit in Rio, religious leaders gathered on the sidelines while pragmatic officials hammered out the ambiguous and secular goal of, quote, sustainable development. 4 years later, leaders of religious faiths met in Assisi, Italy, to draw up a manifesto on, quote, spirituality and sustainability. That must have been 1996. In 1993, the National Religious Partnership for the Environment was born in New York City and began issuing revised doctrinal materials emphasizing the environment. At St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York, that happened. The doors started opening on St. Francis Day to a blessing of the animals, including camels, horses, frogs, birds, and butterflies freely wandering the sanctuary. John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, Rachel Carson, and Chief Seattle were studied in a new and reverential light. The Catholic theologian Thomas Berry synthesized science and spirituality in his epic, The Dream of the Earth. Finally, the time of a new revelation seems to have arrived. By adding a moral and spiritual foundation to the environmental argument, the battle against the climate deniers and modern pharaohs will be joined at the highest human level. That's according to Tom Hayden. That's pretty potent. And he's laying out, which only Tom Hayden tends to do, the historical undercurrents that lead to an event. Nothing is just springs from itself. It's always so he takes you back to 1992 with the first UN summit and the religious leaders gathering and all those other contributors and the current of the liberation theology and the concept of the poor and social issues being integrated into Catholicism and the other Catholic environmental movements that are at work. Actually, Tom Hayden starts his article off with something called the St. Francis Pledge, which I had never heard of. But apparently, there's the Catholic organization, one of the Catholic environmental organizations, their members take the St. Francis Pledge, which there's five things. They pledge to pray and reflect on the duty to care for God's creation and protect the poor and vulnerable. They pledge to learn about and educate others on the causes and moral dimensions of climate change. And they pledge to assess how we as individuals in our families, parishes, and other affiliations contribute to climate change by our own energy use, consumption, and waste. And they pledge to act to change our choices and behaviors to reduce the ways we contribute to climate change. That's something that Tom Hayden says has been going on already for years, before even Francis became Pope. This St. Francis Pledge
Fantastic.
Is part of the Catholic environmental movement. So this all just really brings me a sense of hope because... Well, you know, the heavy artillery on the other side is getting oiled up, and it is there. I mean, oiled up not just a figure of speech. The oil industry, the gas industry, the people, the Monsanto people that are accusing so many people who are opposing the GMO use of being science deniers. They're using that against those that are concerned about their food. So,
oh my God, the Orwellian newspeak is just too much, really.
And it's being done. You know, who owns science now? The fact that the Pope has staked a claim for part of the scientific community is a good step.
Yeah.
It's a good step to combine it with spirituality and ethics.
And his clarity is admirable, and I think he will help other people reach clarity.
I would hope that he reaches the left and that the left reaches out to him. I know there's so many people on the left that admire him and are buoyed up. But this, I think there are people on the right wing that are, you go on YouTube, you see him being portrayed as the Antichrist, literally, as an embodiment of the Antichrist. And the Heartland Institute is out there picketing him, saying that, calling people on the internet and getting them to call and say, and stop the Pope from calling it a climate crisis. It's right in the middle of it. He's right in the middle of it. And we're right up against it. So, Una Doherty didn't have much, your book again.
Oh, yes. It's called During the Truce. It'll be out sometime in September, and it's about my time in Bogota, Colombia, when the guerrillas and the army were in truce, and what I observed there. I did actually go to a Liberation Theology church in Bogota.
And what was that like?
It was really interesting. You have to read the book.
It's okay. And you'll have a show for us this month, at the end of the month, next week?
Yes. Janet Alfs is coming in to talk about feminist and lesbian history in Northampton. Janet Alfs is a former poet laureate. She's a fantastic poet. I hope she'll read us some poems, too, and I think we'll learn a lot from her. Uh-huh. It's going to be fun.
That's next week on the Bread and Roses show. So, Francis and the brother and brother Moon, Sister Earth, however he said that poem, my prayers have turned to Francis on a regular basis to protect him, because someone like him in his position of power is a target, unfortunately. And I wish that others will just send him the best energy, most positive, loving energy.
Sure, he's sending us good energy, and we'll return the favor.
All right. There's the theme song. So that is the end of this edition of the Bread and Roses show. Again, next week, Una Doherty will be your host with a good show. Do stay tuned. Check out our blog at breadandrosesradio.wordpress.com.
That the sun discloses. Oh.